We are tonight's entertainment.
You can't handle the truth.
The fire rises.
Pizza time.
You're a wizard, Harry.
So it begins.
You know how much I sacrifice?
You think that's air you're breathing?
Groovy.
I don't have friends. I got family.
We are
Services.
Hey Trent.
Hi Parth.
How's it going?
Good. You're looking well.
It's good to see you. We saw each other just last night.
Indeed. You look as well as you did back then. But you said you came on this morning, you're like, I shaved, and I was like, cool.
Yeah, I was gonna say I felt so clean and like I look like a little baby boy now. But Trent kind of just doesn't care about me or my physical appearance at all. Which is cool.
No,
I mean, it's just good to know that about your friends.
Well, what I said is that you can ask your friends to notice a haircut, but asking them to notice a shave is asking a bit much.
Unless I'm doing No Shave November, in which case I think it becomes very obvious once I've shaved.
You look at the calendar, you're like, it's November, and then, you know, it all makes sense.
No.
But Parth, if you don't mind me asking, what have you been eating?
I'm so glad you asked, Trent. I have had a bit of a...
We have a film podcast, by the way.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I slept over at friend of the show Sophia Alexis's house. Scandalous, I know.
Yeah, co-ed sleepover.
The reasoning for which is that I'm about to go into production on a movie that friend of the show Adam Volerich is directing. And she has a bunch of decorations at her house that I needed to pick up that we're using for the movie for free. And so I got that in the morning, got them all over here. Then I had to take a shower, shave my face so that Trent could notice. He didn't. And then I was like, oh, wait, shit, we have the what have we been eating section. So I ran downstairs with my laptop in hand and took a handful of Cinnamon Toast Crunch, shoved that shit in my mouth and ate it.
Oh, Cinnamon Toast Crunch was coveted. That was, for some reason, like Lucky Charms and other Cookie Crisp, that was considered like too grotesque to be brought into our home. But Cinnamon Toast Crunch was like right on the border of like being allowed. So that was like really at the brink of good sugary cereals.
Trent, what about you? What have you been eating?
Yeah, I didn't eat anything today, but I can get away with it because what I ate last night has to do with you.
Oh. So,
because it was a grilled chicken club from White Rose Diner, because after we had our show last night, Anthony Grisefo, friend off the show, roommate, was like, let's go to White Rose. And then I was like, I'm willing to drive. And he was like, no, I'll drive. And then it's like, usually we were like fighting over who was going to drive. And he was like, I feel like driving will like reinvigorate me. And I was like,
wow.
Okay, bro. I was like, okay, bro, you fucking drive. And then he drove us. We picked up friend of the show, Jordan Sikafoos. And then we got White Rose milkshakes and a grilled chicken club, which has to do with you because we saw Civil War together.
Oh, yeah.
Which may or,
up later in the episode.
May come up later in the episode. And while we were reviewing it, we snuck in our various snacks and, I was eating this sandwich, and it was divided into four pieces, and I was feeling sort of self-conscious about it. It was just during the trailers. I'm not like an animal. And then Parth came in. I was like, Parth, you want a piece of the sandwich? And he had just spoken earlier, because we recorded the pod, that you were eating chicken curry with your dad, so I was expecting a staunch rejection, and you were like, give me some of that. And then me and Parth, very chummy, rubbing the elbows, ate our sandwiches during the trailers before Civil War. And I ate the same thing last night.
How wonderful. What a wonderful story you just told. Just like the wonderful interview we're going to have on the other side of this intro that we're going to cue.
Yeah, that was a mouthful.
Yeah, cue the intro. Welcome back to Craft Services, where we talk about the movies. Each week we talk about a film and hopefully have a crew member of that film to talk with us about their experience working on the picture. This week, Trent, are we continuing our conversation with Ben Saracen about his work on Godzilla X Kong: The New Empire? Or am I just a fucking idiot?
Wait, is this the Ben Saracen, like, the cinematographer who's also worked on such films as, like, Unstoppable, Pain and Gain, and World War Z?
That's the guy.
But as well as Adam Wingard's film for this week, Adam Wingard's Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, which I mistakenly, in our first interview, foolishly called Godzilla versus Kong, The New Empire.
Like a fucking idiot.
You, having not seen the film at the time, were still quick to correct me, to put me back on crack.
I always am. Yeah. If there's one thing I love about this podcast is that it provides me with infinite opportunities to sort of put you in your place.
Yes, you say don't bet against you, as in don't bet against Parth on the pod, and then sometimes you prove people wrong in the real world, and then you like give me like that look, and it's like... It's like the don't get bet against Parth look.
Well,
you know what I
mean?
Actually,
a few days ago, I was at your apartment and...
That's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, we were talking with Anthony Graceffo, friend off the show, and he was saying something about an actress from The Wolverine, and I was like, she's not green in the movie, she's blonde. He was like, no, she's green. And I was like, don't bet against Parth. And then he looked her up, and she was blonde and not green. And
what
then
do you
I gave
mean,
you a
her
look.
Skin, her hair? What do you...
He was saying that her skin was green, and I think that her hair was red or something. And I was like, that's incorrect. She's just white and blonde. And she's got, like some skin that she, like, peels off, and it has, like, a green tint, but she does not have green skin, like, throughout the movie. And then I showed it to him, and or he searched it up and found it on his own, and then I gave you a look of, what did I say? But honestly, what did I say? I said, don't bet against Parth, which you should never do.
And what I said was asking Ben Saracen, you know, the back half of our series of interview questions, frankly.
Yeah, he gets into some cool stuff. We get a little bit out of Godzilla X Kong territory in this one and start talking about Michael Bay, Tony Scott. Ooh, he talks a bit about Tom Cruise. Totally forgot about that.
Yeah, we talk about the coffee cart and
the classic coffee cart
and World War Z and it's fun and Tony Scott and Michael Bay and everything.
Okay,
in between.
Well, stuff I said, but yeah, it's a pretty good interview, and we have another pretty good interview coming up, but you're not going to be able to figure out what it is until you've listened to this one, guys.
But I am willing to go on the record as saying that if you complete this interview and then listen to Parth and I's additional PS at the end, then that is the time at which we will reveal what our next episode is.
Without further ado, here's Ben Saracen, part two. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, like, the equipment you were working with. You spoke a little bit about working with Panavision, I think. And sort of you could talk about camera, lenses, lights, and sort of what kind of playbook you decided to build.
Yeah, we were keen on this film. We shot the last movie 65mm with spherical lenses, and that felt like a great choice for that film. But in the interest of developing the look and the journey further, we decided on this to shoot anamorphic. So we shot Panavision 1.65 anamorphic lenses, Ultra Vistas. That was our main lens package, supported by, as I said earlier, these bespoke anamorphics we built, which were based on Petzval lenses, which are originally spherical lenses, but we used them and adapted them and built Panavision built anamorphic lenses based on those. So that was our main lens package. Shot Arri Alexa Mini LFs, and then had, you know, various other smaller cameras as backup. Generally we tend to shoot single camera. It just works for us in terms of, because we're quite specific with coverage, and we know, well, Adam's really good with editorially. He has great sort of understanding of what's needed within a shot and a scene. And so we just find it's quicker and more sort of pleasing just to work with a single camera. It creates a sense of focus for the actors and for us to really be less compromising with the shooting. You know, with one camera, you can always put the camera in the right spot for in terms of what your perception is, but it can always be where you want it to be. As soon as you start working with two or more cameras, there's invariably a feeling of, or a potential feeling of compromise. You're not quite there. So tend to shoot single camera, and it worked on the first film, and we were keen just to carry that on with this film.
This is a nuts and bolts question, but where was the principal photography and how long was the shoot?
We shot mainly in Australia on the Gold Coast, where there's a big studio complex. Warner Brothers has a studio complex there. So that was our main shooting base. There are also great locations quite nearby that supported what we needed. We went up to northern Queensland in Australia for some of the jungle shooting for a couple of weeks. And then we went to Morocco at the end of the film for, I think, a week or two to finish a range of sequences, but predominantly, you know, the Egypt Cairo scenes and a few others. And I think our shooting lasted, you know, on and off over the course of about 4.5 months, something like that. I think 4.5, 5 months. Relatively short number of shooting days for a movie of this scale because there was so much CG in it.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you know, pretty lengthy time.
Just to sort of close out some of the Godzilla X Kong questions, what would you say was different about working on the sequel? I mean, I guess Godzilla versus Kong is also a sequel, but a sequel to the previous work that you worked on. What was like the biggest thing going into this one that you felt prepared you better or gave you some sort of new outlook on this movie because you had worked on a movie like that before?
I think because we were fairly pleased with our approach on the first one, it gave us the opportunity to go a bit further in that direction and directions based on where we'd been the first time round. I think we also felt like there was an opportunity to be much more refined with our visualization approach, have a very specific sort of plan with the realization of the film. And I think, you know, once you've done one, you can then look back at that film and see what worked in terms of the sequences, what was more effective and what was less effective. And you know, it's great going into another movie armed with that information. Not that you want to just build a world that's based on knowledge and safety, but more that you can really happily eliminate things that, you know, didn't work great for you in a way. You know, and that's a huge advantage. You just the language gets more refined and more specific.
So Parth, are you ready to close out on Godzilla X Kong and move to the more general filmography questions?
I think we're ready.
Outstanding. So looking at your IMDb, there's just a very like sort of notable jump. In 2009, you work on a TV, you DP a TV movie, Free Agents, and you also DP Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. And the scale of those two things are very funny and notable. And just how did you get involved with that? And also, just looking at your IMDb, you continue to work with Michael Bay after. So just how'd you get involved?
Yeah, that was interesting. So I, you know, as I said to you, I'd sort of started working commercials when I started as a cinematographer, and then was pretty much involved in lower budget independent movies and TV. I came to LA prior to Transformers, and got an opportunity to work with Gore Verbinski when good friend of mine, Derek Wolski, left Pirates 3 to start another movie. And they still had a month or so to shoot on the end of Pirates. And he introduced me to Gore, and we got on really well. And I finished up Pirates, which was really my opportunity to do a big, you know, get involved in a big Hollywood movie. And that then led to, you know, the fortune of being, you know, started to be offered bigger sort of things. And the first project that came along that felt appealing was, you know, to work with Bay. And, you know, that was behind that particular part of the journey.
You also worked on Tony Scott's last film, Unstoppable. And as I've grown up, the more I really love Tony Scott's movies. And if you could just sort of talk about working on that one and shooting on a train, you know?
Yeah, Tony was a phenomenon. And you know, first and foremost, an amazing human being, you know, big-hearted man with a love of people, love of cinema. Had a particular style that is, you know, well and truly known and loved. And, you know, a couple of the many great things about Tony were he loved shooting multiple cameras all the time. There would always be 4 to 6 cameras going the whole time. Whether it was a dialogue scene or whether it was a huge action scene, he loved that sort of coverage, and he loved the use of long lenses. If you know, for those who are familiar with his work, which made shooting multiple cameras, you know, really, you know, possible in the way he did it. So you know, really, really interesting. The other part of his working process, which was fantastic, is he wanted to do everything in camera. So, you know, we initially in the meetings, we talked about logistics and the approach to the filming. And, you know, the story is obviously this huge runaway train with something like 38 carriages behind it. Well, you know, rational, logical thinking in that sort of scenario would say, look, this is a great opportunity to use CG to really make the shooting process much simpler and, you know, logistically more manageable, because you're going to be in a situation where most of the time you'll have a shot of one train car engine or, you know, first 2 or 3 carriages, and the rest of the 37 of them are going to be in the distance. And so you're not really ever going to see them in great detail. So do it all in CG, you know. Tony didn't want to follow that route at all. He was like, we're doing everything for real. I don't care. And that was really the beauty of him. He was a real purist in terms of a love of, you know, getting everything in camera. And with all the problems that brings, but also all the benefits, all the unknowns that you really you just can't tell until you're there with all the elements there. And, you know, even to this day, there's, you know, directors like Nolan who are just adamant about this sort of stuff, and it overlaps into shooting on film. But it's there's something, you know, Denis Villeneuve said the same thing of Dune 2. It's like I've got to shoot in the desert. And many, many filmmakers and certainly many producers and studios would make a huge case for doing these sort of projects with digital enhancement, let's say. But, you know, it's clear that there are real benefits to doing things for real, that the unknown things that come up and the unanticipated sort of events and situations where you can never imagine what might happen when you're out in the middle of nowhere. And Tony was an absolute advocate and lover of that sort of being out in the elements and everything that it entailed, dealing with, you know, all the benefits of that and all the problems. It brings a sort of quality to the filmmaking that you just can't replicate. You can't replicate it. And it's not to say it's better than digital work, but it takes you down a path that's very rewarding and authentic. And yeah, I love that about him.
So speaking of people that do things for real, regardless of how insane or difficult or mind-boggling it is, you've worked on a Tom Cruise movie, The Mummy.
Oh, yeah.
Trent knows this. The listeners know this. I'm like the world's biggest Tom Cruise fan. So anything, any cool story you have, and also if you could talk about the zero-G sequence.
Yeah, well, any cool story? There are many. Let me talk about the zero-G. The zero-G journey's phenomenal. For those that don't know how these sequences are filmed, there's a few places you can do this, but you basically, very simply, fly up in an aircraft of 30-odd thousand feet, and you end up spending the day doing effectively a roller coaster ride nonstop, where the plane will climb to the altitude, and to get the zero G feel, it'll go into a curving dive where you can actually create a sense of zero G. You're floating. You're actually dropping, but you're floating by appearance. So, you know, you do that several times, you know, 13, 14, 15 times for, you know, very short spaces of time. You pull out of the dive, you climb up, and it allows you to shoot, you know, chunks of sequences that seemingly are in zero G. It's challenging from a physical point of view. There's a propensity to get very airsick very quickly, which generally a good percentage of the crew do get, but they're prepared for that, and you just have to deal with it. But it obviously gives you fantastic footage, and you know you can't really replicate that. Often wires, you know, you use wires, you can go some degree in certain limited way, you know, replicating a floating environment, but there's no substitute for doing it for real. Tom Cruise stories, yeah, there are many. I mean, the guy is the consummate professional. I've never met an actor with a more dedicated technical ability and curiosity. You know, I at the beginning of the movie, we shot Anamorphic on film. And I decided, as I often do, that before leaping into this, I wanted to really understand every anamorphic lens and every idiosyncrasy and quality of any available anamorphic lens. And I launched into this process of, you know, exhaustive testing and pretty banal and boring locations, but places that would really demonstrate to me how the lenses operated. So I think I ended up shooting most of them in a very dreary supermarket shopping area, I guess, in a pretty dreary part of London. and had hours and hours of footage by the end. And Tom, who's forever curious about every aspect of filmmaking, said to me after I'd done the test, he said, "Ben, I want to watch all these with you." And I said, "Tom, it's like 16 hours of a shot of a supermarket interior. I mean, you can go crazy." But he was insistent, and he sat in and he wanted to understand what I felt were the benefits of some lenses and what were the benefits of others, and how they performed and how they worked. And that sort of summed him up. You know, he's obsessive like that. And it's great because it makes the films better. You know, it's well known fact that he does all his own stunts, but not only does he do all his own stunts, he'll do all the inserts on many movies. You'll have, you know, a famous celebrity actor who'll do their performance, and then you might need a close-up of the actor looking at his watch to check the time. And Tom doesn't allow anyone to do that stuff because he says in his mind he has a certain sort of manner and way of behaving and a physicality that is unable to be replicated, as everyone does. But for him, the authenticity of that is hugely important. So he'll wait an extra hour or two at the end of the day to get a shot of him looking at his watch, a point of view of his watch, where it could be anyone, theoretically. And that's great. It's great to have an actor that engaged and dedicated. It makes it, you know, a lot easier for us as well.
We've interviewed quite a few people that have worked with the man, the myth, the legend. One question that's just sort of a random non sequitur. Did you have any experience with his coffee cart?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had the coffee cart. Yeah.
Yeah.
I gave up coffee after that. It was too good. But we had the coffee cart, and it's just great to have it there the whole time.
Yeah. That was it.
So, reading your bio earlier, Parth and I were both a little, we saw World War Z, but then we saw in your bio that you split DP credit with Robert Richardson, and we were wondering how that came to be.
Yeah, so World War Z had an interesting journey into its final iteration, I guess, that, you know, it's a known fact that it was somewhat problematic, the shooting. They initially shot the movie, then it was decided at the end of the first stage of shooting that there needed to be extensive reshoots, and that journey was, you know, quite complex just logistically and, you know, for the studio to work out what they needed and wanted from the reshoots. That was a bit of a journey. So Bob shot the initial part of the film. In fact, the bulk of it. They then went through a process, as I say, of, you know, working out different parts of reshoots that were needed. There were again, a couple of opportunities for them to do that. And I joined the project after Bob went on to another production. I joined for the final chunk where we reshot a good part of the ending for the movie, in conjunction with some earlier sequences in the film as well. So, you know, not untypical for these big movies. It's not unusual for a cinematographer to start a film and not be able to finish the project. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to pick it up. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of Bob's work. He's really one of the legends. So it was great to have the opportunity to collaborate with them and really pick up the baton and carry on, you know, that journey. I think the results were interesting and people seemed to like it, so we're really pleased.
Is there anything you're working on right now that you are able to talk about?
Nothing solid at the moment. I've been doing commercials for the last few months. Obviously, there's, you know, it's an interesting time with the industry. There's a lot of turmoil and change at the moment. I'm very lucky that I've always kept a foot in the commercial world, and you know, I love that because, as I said earlier when we were talking, it just creates a great opportunity to experiment with techniques and different equipment, different styles, and different approaches. So, you know, I'm keen now to do something quite different from, you know, a big CG movie. What I love about the work and my job is that, you know, you have these opportunities just to switch genres and, you know, styles of work. So I'm excited about doing something small and, you know, maybe a more character driven, smaller scale sort of human based story maybe next time.
Trent, do you think it's time?
Oh, time for the Big Kahuna final question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Outstanding. Don't be intimidated. The Big Kahuna final question is, what is the last great film you've watched? And the one note is that it can't just be good. It has to be great.
And it could be a first time or a rewatch.
The last great film. God, there's so many. I think I'm really interested in films that, I'm interested in everything. That in answer to your questions, when I feel a film succeeds with certain sort of challenges, that really excites me because, you know, many films work in a way that you could predict they would be great when you look at really what they're about, who's involved, actors, director, crew, all that sort of stuff. What really blew me away with Oppenheimer was, and I'm sure everyone cites this film, is basically it's a movie about people talking. Now, it's very challenging to keep engaged, you know, keep people engaged in a film like that, whatever the content, the story, and the script. It's really challenging to be able to do it with a sense of scale in the way that Chris and Hoyta did and keep you not just engaged but totally immersed in it, and for it to work, you know, against the odds is just such an achievement, you know. And it's stating the obvious, I know everyone said this, but you know, in answer to your question, when you see films like that succeed, you just know that anything's possible in the film world, really. And I just loved it. Hats off to those guys. That just is a phenomenon.
Yeah, Oppenheimer has been a very popular last great film you've watched. It's an undeniable pick.
It's 3-hour black and white historical drama, but it's so engaging. It defies everything. And it grossed a crazy amount of money. It's impossible.
Yeah. Right.
Parth, can I bring us out?
Yeah, please.
Thank you again to Ben Saracen, our guest and cinematographer of such films as Unstoppable, Pain and Gain, World War Z, and of course, our film for today, Adam Wingard's Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Whoa! What an interview, Trent.
Yeah, what a thrill.
Whoa! It's crazy how we just had to wait for like 30 minutes while the interview played in front of us.
Yeah, we listened back to the interview in its entirety, and then that is what gave us the energy to do this additional commentary.
But that was, in all reality, that was a pretty cool interview, though, was it not?
Yeah, I was like thrilled Ben Saracen came. He was really like, this is a good opportunity for us.
And thank you. Thank you to Ben
Saracen. Thank you. Awesome guest. Thank you for your time. One, yeah, really cool. One thing I'll say though, a little disappointed Godzilla nor Kong showed up. I like thought that that was going to be like part of the deal.
I mean, I guess we established last week that I am Godzilla and you are Kong. So I guess in that way we showed up, or they showed up, but it was more sort of in spirit. You know what I mean?
Interesting. Yeah, in spirit, you know, if need be, like if they were homesick, we could fill in, like as an understudy. But I was expecting like them to like hop on the Zoom.
Yeah. No, I get where you're. I'm picking up where you're putting down.
Or Parth, like, dare I say, what, was I naive to expect the new Empire to show up?
Well, the Frozen Empire showed up for Ghostbusters, so you would expect the new one to show up as well. But Trent, do we have another guest showing up next week, or am I fucking crazy?
No, as we teased earlier, we do have additional episodes. And you know, to tie it in with what I ate earlier, just to put a big bow on the episode, as we mentioned earlier, Alex Garland, Civil War. That's the next film we're covering. And like, I don't, Parth, I'm just, something I liked about Civil War is that there was a bunch of actors in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
a bunch, like they were all acting and talking, speaking dialogue,
reacting.
That's just something I really respected. That's one of the things I loved most about the movie. Funny thing.
We got an actor.
Or dare I say an actor.
Hmm. yeah, so we got Jefferson White. He's got a role as a war journalist in the film. And he's also, for all you Yellowstone heads out there, he's Jimmy from Yellowstone. And he's shown up in a lot of movies recently, and he's a very cool guy, and also currently my boss.
Wow, that puts like a weird spin on things.
Yeah, doesn't it?
And now that we know that Parth is employed by him, I was gonna say this anyway, but it was really, really like not any shade on our other interviews, but it was like a disproportionately fun interview solely because Parth had a relationship with him prior, so the ice was already broken.
It was weird interviewing someone I'd already known that you don't know Jeff really. I think that was your first time talking to him, but I think it was a pretty cool interview, and I think it's coming out next week Sunday. Not that anyone fucking cares, but
I don't.
Oh, okay, thanks. Well, you were just in the interview. But yeah, you can check us out on all our major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google. Well, no more Google Podcasts. That's not a thing anymore. Pandora.
Dude. We literally,
dang!
I'm the co-host of this podcast, barely. And we've never mentioned Google Podcasts before. So
that's
like
not true.
So like it's fine that it's gone.
Anyways, you can also check us out on our social media on Instagram and Twitter. Post updates for the show there. Trent, anything else we're missing? I think we're good, right?
Plus, like, I'm off Twitter, man. So what do you do about the Craft Services Twitter? You still do that, like, sparingly? You like?
Yeah, no, I still have Twitter on my, like, I'll access Twitter on my laptop. But
plus off the personal account.
For
any fans of his infrequent, sporadic fame.
Yeah.
It's
all
true.
Right. So we, that's a wrap on this one, guys. And we'll see you next week.